Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, October 28th, 2025, we're delighted to host this discussion entitled Law Firm Discrimination Investigations. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Jonathan Siegel and Allison Soman as our speakers, and Dan Morinoff as our moderator. Mr. Morinoff is Executive Director and Secretary at the American Civil Rights Project and an Adjunct Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. One last note, throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Mr. Morinoff, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I appreciate all of you who are here to listen, not so much to me, but really to Allison and Jonathan. As was briefly intimated, they're great. Jonathan's partner at Duane Morris. Allison comes to us from PLF. Read more about them on our website or their own. I believe, Allison, you're going to launch us off here. We're discussing the various investigations, or what we assume are investigations, into law firm practices at the EEOC. I know there was a lot of attention that perhaps had been placed onto some very early in the administration actions taken by the president about particular law firms. Those were kind of scattershot onesie-twosie events. This is an effort to discuss what appear to be more systematic efforts by an agency with actual investigative authority. So please, what can you tell us?
Thank you so much, Dan, for that kind introduction. As you alluded to, I am here today to talk about federal enforcement of anti-discrimination laws against large law firms. The legal hook for these enforcement efforts has been Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits, among other forms of discrimination, race and color discrimination against persons of any race and against persons of all races. Going back decades, all the way to the 1970s, the Supreme Court has consistently held that Title VII prohibits, quote, discriminatory preference for any group, minority or majority, close quote. Some limited exceptions to this general principle exist. In 1978, in Weber versus United Steelworkers, the Supreme Court held that employers may take race-conscious steps to, quote, eliminate manifest racial imbalances in traditionally segregated job categories. Still, Weber's exception has never been, and should not be, understood to swallow the whole. Nonetheless, some large law firms have pushed on the limits of this exception, which is what led to the investigative efforts that we're seeing today. It appears that the current Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has, after years of largely looking the other way, finally decided to probe more closely into these practices. In March of this year, it sent letters to 20 large law firms inquiring about their DEI practices. I want to be clear that this is not an official investigation. Replies from the law firms are voluntary, but I think it's fair to say that the kinds of questions posed in these letters are a signal of how the EEOC would respond to future complaints of discrimination in the law firm context. Each letter is individualized to the practices of a particular large law firm, but there are some common themes that emerge. Here's a list of practices that are asked about multiple times in the letters, and in my view, all of these are practices you should probably avoid if you don't want your law firm or other employer to be investigated by the EEOC. Diversity fellowships that are limited to students or young attorneys from particular racial ethnic backgrounds are a common concern. They're asked about frequently. Stipends that are available only to law students or participants in diversity fellowship programs, again, when these diversity fellowship programs are restricted to students from certain races. In some cases, we see inquiries about tuition reimbursement or scholarships that are open to diversity fellowship recipients, again, when these programs appear to be open only to students from certain racial and ethnic backgrounds. Another area of concern, resource groups or employee affinity groups that are limited to employees from a certain racial or ethnic background, those are unlawful under Title VII, and those are of concern to this EEOC. One particular nonprofit that comes up again and again in the EEOC letters is Sponsors for Educational Opportunity. SEO is distinctive because it brings zero L's or students who haven't yet started law school, who will the following fall, into large law firms and pays them at rates comparable to those of summer associates who are already in law school. The SEO program is noteworthy because it's lucrative. There aren't that many jobs out there that pay students with no real legal training at summer associate rates, and also because it really gives a hand up in the hiring process for 1L summer and 2L summer to students who already have some law firm experience under their belt. There's some dispute about whether SEO is racially restrictive. The letters quote conflicting language from the SEO website about who's eligible for the program. There's some language on the SEO website that seems to indicate that it's open to everybody, or at least everybody from certain underserved groups that aren't necessarily racial groups, such as veterans or first-generation college students. On the other hand, there's language elsewhere on the website that strongly suggests that SEO is open exclusively, or at least preferentially, to students from certain racial and ethnic groups. If that's true, that violates Title VII, and the EEOC is right to encourage law firms to look at this more closely. Another common area of legal concern, hiring goals or diversity goals that are posted on law firm websites. These go by different names. I see the name Race Equity Action Plan, DEI Action Plan. But the common legal concern is this. If a law firm has a goal, there's a strong implication that the law firm is likely discriminating in order to achieve that goal. And that, again, would violate Title VII. The common through line through all these practices is that the law firm's DEI practice is being challenged because it shows favoritism towards students or attorneys based on their race, national origin, or based on their sex. These practices may be well-intentioned, but they run afoul of laws that clearly prohibit all discrimination and that have been consistently interpreted to do so for decades. The leadership of the EEOC has finally shown intent to enforce all law, and that's a good thing. So why are we here? One would think that large law firms, these are people who can't really plead ignorance or inability to understand the law as an excuse. Why are they cheating on the law in this manner? And why have they been doing so for a long time? I mean, I can't say for 100% certain, but I humbly submit that it's at least in part because of the tension between disparate treatment law and disparate impact law. To review these categories briefly, disparate treatment refers to the form of discrimination when the employer actually treats individuals differently because of their race, sex, or membership in another category that's prohibited under civil rights law. Sometimes it's intentional, conscious, and obvious. Think back to the whites-only days of Jim Crow or the sex-segregated newspaper job ads of yore. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes the bias is subconscious or unconscious, but it's still obvious when looking to all circumstances that an employment decision was ultimately made because of race or sex. With a disparate impact, by contrast, the employer is using a practice that has an adverse effect that's based on race or sex. But the use of the practice itself may or may not be motivated by race or sex. Some common examples whose disparate impact gets challenged: standardized tests or exams for civil service hiring or promotion. Something like a physical size or strength requirement, whereby job applicants have to run a mile in a certain amount of time, lift a certain number of pounds, or do a certain number of push-ups. These physical size tests will commonly have a disparate impact based on sex, because men as a group, on average, are stronger than women on average and as a group. It doesn't matter that the employer may not mean for the test to be discriminatory or to have this effect. It only matters that the test, in fact, has the adverse effect. In theory, a practice that has an adverse effect is lawful if it can be justified by business necessity. Some examples: the employer needs to use a test because people who do well on the written exam make better firefighters. Or the employer has a business necessity to use a physical exam because prison guards need to be physically strong or police officers need to be able to run fast. The problem is that the courts don't really agree on what that business necessity requirement means. For some courts, business necessity is met when the employer can articulate a reason for the practice that makes sense and isn't obviously a pretext for discrimination. On other occasions, necessity is interpreted as something more stringent, something where it really has to be a life or death matter for the business if this practice isn't being used. Under that tougher standard, many employment practices won't pass. Employers look around at this legal landscape, they're risk averse, and they simply wind up choosing the strategies that will minimize their risk of a disparate impact liability suit. How does an employer avoid liability for disparate impact? All too often, employers try to do so by making sure that there's proportional representation of all groups in the workforce. An employer is safest from a disparate impact lawsuit when its workforce is 50% male and 50% female, or when racial and ethnic groups are represented in proportion to their share of the population. But the problem is that much of the time, employers wind up discriminating against overrepresented groups to get those numbers that they desire. In other words, they wind up violating Title VII's prohibitions on disparate treatment in order to avoid a disparate impact lawsuit. I can't say for sure that that's what's happened in large law firms, but it's possible they've looked around, they've noticed that some groups are underrepresented in their ranks, and they're worried about disparate impact liability. But the problem is that it's not lawful for them to violate Title VII's prohibition on disparate treatment to try to solve that problem. And I'm glad that the EEOC is finally taking action to stop large law firms from doing that. Eliminating race discrimination means eliminating all of it. That line is from a Supreme Court decision about race purposes in education from just 2 years ago, the Students for Fair Admissions Consolidated cases. Because those cases are about education, they're not binding precedent here. But it does, I think, nicely encapsulate the principles undergirding employment discrimination law. And I think it also nicely summarizes this administration's correct approach to interpreting employment laws. If you take away only one thing from my presentation today, let it be this. The employment discrimination laws require that individuals be treated as individuals and not on the basis of their race and sex. Some large law firms have turned away from that principle and tried to eliminate bias by putting a thumb on the scale for members of underrepresented groups. That approach has left them vulnerable to investigations from the EEOC and to private claims. If you work at a large law firm or another employer that's tempted to use DEI preferences of a sort, don't make that mistake. Don't get investigated. Don't risk unnecessary lawsuits that detract from a mission of providing excellent service to your clients. Don't put a thumb on the scale based on race or sex in hiring, promotion, and other employment decisions. Thank you.
Jonathan, I believe that you also have some top-level introductory thoughts and perhaps responses to what Allison might have said. We'd love to hear them before. I know I have a few questions, and I suspect others will as well.
After 6 years, I'll remember to take off the mute. Honored to be with you folks and to be with FedSoc again. Let me begin by saying that for the most part, what we're talking about is not a change in the law, but in change in enforcement strategy. And different government, different administrations enforce different issues more strongly than others. This administration is focusing heavily on where does DEI, which is not unlawful in and of itself, go over the line and descend into discrimination. And Allison has done a wonderful job of giving background of where this may occur. Some general rules for law firms to consider, and then I want to open up with a couple areas that I think are some interesting for discussion. Obviously, no quotas. And I should note that the EEOC's letters, it's actually whether you're a law firm or not, gives you insight into what the EEOC is looking at. So I appreciate the transparency and the heads up for law firms and other employers and what they may or may not do. I think we all know a quota is unlawful, but as Allison said, an aspirational goal, we wanna have 50% women, 50% men. That's either gonna be akin to a quota or incenting unlawful consideration of race or sex. And highly risky. An interesting question is, can an employer say, look, I don't have a numerical goal. I just have as a goal increasing diversity, quantitative, not qualitative. And when you look at the EEOC's guidance that it issued, question number 7 is, under Title VII, an employer initiative policy or program may be unlawful if it involves an employer or other covered entity taking an employment action motivated in whole or in part by race, sex, or other protected characteristic. When I read that language, when I read parallel language in the DOJ guidance, I think it's a fair statement to say that if a law firm or other entity says, our goal is to increase diversity, they're running a legal risk, even if there's no numerical quotient going with it. And sometimes as lawyers, it's what you say, it's how you say it. You can get to the same result. If an employer says, I want to recruit at Howard to increase the diversity of my summer associate class, that may be unlawful. I'm using the word may because I'm not sure. I'm not giving legal advice. This is specific factual situations. If you say, I want to recruit there because of the talent there, I think that probably should be okay. And I think it's a question of thinking about issues the way we did perhaps before 2020 and focusing on skills, knowledge, and ability, and talent in locations, not demographics in locations. But no quotas, aspirational goals are problematic. I think even saying we want to increase diversity without numbers carries with it at least some risk in litigation. Allison mentioned not having a fellowship or an internship only for Black, Latino, maybe not that specific, but particular groups of students. Well, we don't have inclusion by exclusion. And those kinds of set-asides, positions that are only for individuals based on race or sex or color, are going to be problematic. Again, that's not a change in the law. In the law firm world, we saw more of that with sometimes with first-year programs, but it could apply in any program. One of the interesting set-aside issues is, can you say that we would like to have a diverse slate requirement? We're going to have the same standard apply to everyone, but we want to have at least one non-white man on the slate, following the Rooney rule, if you will, from professional football. I think that's an issue that could go either way in the courts. It's not the ultimate employment decision. But employers in general, law firms in particular, the EEOC has put you on notice that those kind of diverse slate requirements it believes violate the law, good faith belief, as has the Department of Justice in its guidance. So then the question becomes, are there other ways to help ensure you have a diverse slate without specifically having a diverse slate requirement? We'll talk about that. We'd all know no pluses because of race, color, or sex. I just wanted to mention that we have the EEOC guidance. I'm sitting here with my DEI book, and then I have the DOJ guidance. And the DOJ says, you know, you can't do by indirection what you can't do directly. So employers need to be thoughtful. Employers can't say, well, we're only looking at underrepresented groups or historically marginalized groups, if that is in fact a proxy for race or color or for sex. Can't have different standards. And by the way, that's legally should be obvious, but the messaging to a workplace that we have different standards for some rather than others is kind of painful even to articulate. I want to spend a moment on two big decisions the Supreme Court came up with in 2023 and 2024. And as Allison aptly said, the Supreme Court decision involving SFA theoretically had nothing to do with employment, but has everything to do with employment, because it's what the Supreme Court, where their heads are. We don't engage in discrimination to end discrimination. ending discrimination means all of it. The Supreme Court, in two decisions, has made it easier for individuals to bring discrimination claims. People may not always realize that, and that would include their ability to attack DEI programs that run afoul. One would be the Muldrow decision, and that involves not an adverse action like we think of hiring or promoting, but a term or condition of employment. And some courts said, well, you need to show a material disadvantage or significant harm. The Supreme Court, per Muldrow, said, nah, you just have to show some harm. That's a really important decision when it comes to cases involving mentoring, leadership development, employee resource groups. If you have a leadership program only open, let's change the dynamics to men, that's going to violate the law, most likely. The same will be true if it's only open to women. And per the EEOC guidance, if you offer the same program with the same resources, but you train women and men separately, that's going to be challenged too. So the Muldrow decision, M-U-L-D-R-O-W, I think is one of the most significant decisions because I'm a recovering litigator. I used to litigate. But you think about it. Someone says this program you offer on mentoring excludes me because I'm a white male and I'm challenging it. The law firm defense would have to be, or any other employer, it doesn't cause some harm because it has no value. Now, that's not a pleasant defense to make, even if you prevail. So I think we need to look at all these programs. And then I have to just mention, outside of Muldrow, the notion that an organization would say we're going to provide special mentoring to Black rather than white associates or in other settings, suggesting that all Black associates need it and then no white associates need it, that would seem to me to be discriminatory at a minimum on the messaging. And then I'll just mention that the last case this year was the Ames decision. And I listened to the decision and I had the honor to be on a FedSoc program discussing it. And I said, it sounds like it's going to be 9-0. And someone said, it's a fool's errand to predict what the Supreme Court will do. And I thought, I'm probably not being a fool, at least today, because as Justice Gorsuch said, there was radical agreement. And even the respondent basically said, how can you have a law that prevents discrimination, that discriminates based on majority versus minority status? And what that means in plain speak is that it's no harder for a man to bring a sex discrimination claim than a woman, for someone white than someone Black, for someone straight than someone gay. And I think that's relevant because the stakes are higher in that it is more likely the individuals aware of the law will challenge. And in fact, in my practice, I'm seeing an increase of what historically we would have called reverse discrimination claims. Now we just call them discrimination claims. So right. I give kudos to the, you know, no one wants to be the law firm getting the letter. Let's be honest about that. But I think all law firms and all employers can look at the letters and say the EEOC, in good faith, has put forth the kind of data that it would look at to evaluate whether there's a violation of the law. I don't think that answering all the questions yes would necessarily mean there's a violation, but it would mean there may be some smoke there. There'll be a cause for concern. So delighted to be with you folks again today and to have a conversation about these issues.
Please. Let me start with one question, just clarifying. Jonathan, you had mentioned guidance that the EEOC had issued. I know the EEOC only recently reacquired a quorum, having lacked one for most of a year. I don't think that they've taken any formal votes on guidance. Is the document you're talking about, how official is it, and how much stock should anyone put on the absence of a vote yet on something along these lines?
So, phenomenal question. as of now, we finally have a quorum. On March 17th, the EOC wrote its letters to the law firm. And on March 19th, it issued a technical assistance guidance. The guidance made clear it's not binding, but it's a window into how Acting Chair Lucas sees these issues. I think it's highly likely that there will be a quorum seeing them. So one could say it's not binding, so I won't look at it, but I'll call it binding minus. It's, or guidance plus. It's insight into how the regulators are going to look at these issues. And I think we would ignore it at our risk.
Sure. While we're talking about the newly acquired quorum, this is a very open-ended question. Is there anything either of you would necessarily expect or predict might be coming now as guidance, perhaps, from the commission now that it can speak as the commission?
Allison, do you?
I don't have a good idea here, no.
I think what Allison and I have been talking about, I wouldn't be surprised if the informal guidance was memorialized into more formal guidance on DEI. Also, religious liberty has often been last in what the EOC has focused on. The same with plaintiffs' lawyers. Acting Chair Lucas, with whom I've had the honor to do work before in this context, has made clear religious freedom is a priority. So I think you're going to see an increase in religious discrimination claims, including bias against Christians and stereotyping. You're going to see an increase in harassment claims. We saw the $20 million settlement for harassment of Jewish employees in a higher education institution. Reasonable accommodation claims. Groff changes the world in terms of how those claims need to be evaluated. And then religious expression. You know, in the HR world, people say, bring your authentic self to work. Some employers say, but leave your faith at the courthouse, at the workplace door. That ain't going to fly. So I think in those four areas, we're likely to see education, I hope. I hope the EOC will educate. And then also legal action.
Sure. Allison, you had mentioned that one possible explanation for the behavior of law firms might be the what is widely described as the conflict between disparate impact and disparate treatment standards. To what extent do you think another explanation might be the demands of clients? And to the extent that that has any explanatory value, would it in any way be legal to listen to such preferences of clients?
So I agree with you that it has some power as an explanation. I've run across anecdotes in these in news stories about clients that want a certain number of women or a certain number of minority lawyers on their teams. That said, client preference is not a defense to violations of the civil rights laws. There was a seminal 11th Circuit case that dealt with a large restaurant that hired only male servers because it created a supposedly high class or old world ambiance. Women who wanted to work there sued. The restaurant raised the supposed client preference as a defense. The court said, no, you can't do this. The supposed preference of your clients is not a defense to this. And so I think similar reasoning would have to apply here.
Okay.
I agree completely. If someone were to say, I remember 25 years ago when a client said, I want a man. And I said that it won't be from my law firm because the most qualified person was a woman. The same answer should be on a given case. But I think a client could say, I'm interested in seeing, not asking for staffing on my case, but I'm interested in knowing the diversity numbers in your firm more generally, because diversity still remains a talent imperative, and we want to cream the crop, and the crop is more diverse each year as the workplaces change. So I think there could be questions. Are you tapping into talent in diverse communities as reflected in your hiring without that being unlawful versus I want, in my case, someone who looks like blank?
So let me build off of that and reflect back on what you'd mentioned earlier about the Rooney Rule. Only because, the usually when we're talking about employment litigation, the provision at issue is 42 USC 2000E2A1, which is the bar on discrimination, the language that always gets quoted, including in Muldrow and in Ames. There is an A2, and the A2 is that section that has prohibited since 1964 the classification of employees or of applicants in any way that might tend to limit their opportunities. And it's not like there's a lot of case law under that section, but it strikes me that it should have something to say about these practices. I mean, that's just literally me talking, but do you have any thought there? How exactly has this section been completely ignored?
Completely what?
Ignored was the word that I used.
Yeah, there's been a couple of sections that have been ignored, but they're not being ignored now. I think it definitely speaks to it. What I don't know and never want to, I don't know how it would be interpreted. If an employer said, we have five candidates and all are white women, and we'd like to add someone who is racial or ethnic diversity, we're adding to it. That would seem to me to be lower risk than saying we have five men and we want to remove one and replace that individual. So I think there's a risk continuum. And I think there's a level of risk tolerance. And I don't think the district courts are going to be unanimous on this. It may be what circuit you're in until eventually, or if eventually, it gets to the high court.
Sure, that's certainly fair. Allison, jumping back just one moment again to the potential conflict between disparate impact and disparate treatment and its explanatory value here. I would assume that any employer, including law firms, would be weighing relative risks anytime they decided how to run that gauntlet. And in that vein, I guess I have to ask, I can't actually think of, and this might just be me, I can't think of any successful disparate impact suits that have been litigated against large law firms. Have I just missed them, or are they out there?
I mean, I'm not aware of any off the top of my head either, but I think you have to think of the incentive structure. Someone who files a complaint with the EEOC, if the EEOC really tries to dig in, that can easily be a year, maybe longer investigation of the large law firm, document production back and forth. The incentive is almost always to settle or give the person what he or she wants, because it's simply not cost effective to drag things out all the way to the point that a lawsuit gets to court. So I think that in many cases, even if the actual risk of a complaint that makes it to court is low, the law firm figures better not risk a complaint rather than risk being dragged through a punitive administrative process.
Sure. Jonathan, I should ask you, what can employers fairly do? What is the, let's say that there's an employer that is out there and they want to assure that they are including diverse talent in their workforce. And let's assume that they, in fact, do not want to discriminate or at least be labeled as someone who is. What could they do, to what degree safely?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. And if you don't mind, there's the attraction of talent, which is one prong of the statute. And then there's the terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. If you don't mind, let me start with number two. The mentorship programs, the leadership development programs, the employee resource groups. these kinds of programs were developed because they have value. They may help employees feel more connected to the organization. And then that's going to be business accretive to the extent it impacts positively the bottom line. What employers should be doing is, if they have these programs, asking the question. No one is saying get rid of them. If you have a women's initiative, number one, it should be open to men. Number two, it should be not only explicitly, but functionally. So if you have a women's initiative, but only women are invited, and there's a secret email list of who gets included, that's going to be a problem. And there shouldn't be segregation between women and men. You know, sometimes people say, well, what if women want to talk separately or men want to talk about separately? That doesn't have to be always part of an ERG. I think people forgot an important concept: lunch. Not everything needs to be a formal employer program. So I think a lot of these programs, focusing more on mentoring, focusing more on sponsorship, and it doesn't even have to be open to all. It just has to be open to all that are similarly situated without regard to race, sex, or other protected characteristic or a proxy. So you could say we want to offer a leadership program for high potential associates. It just can't be high potential women or high potential Black employees. It has to be all employees. And of course, something like that is subjective. So you need to make sure that you have some guardrails in the criteria. But I think a lot of what we've done to increase inclusion, let's just go to the extent there are limitations. Let's get rid of the illegal limitations, but keep what's beneficial about them. On the attracting and retaining talent, I think we can look at, are there, number one, we want to cast a broad net. Now, if someone says, I want to cast a broad net to increase diversity, are we now into that motivational issue? I want to cast a broad net so we have visibility in myriad communities. I think the why, the word choice becomes important. I think we want to look at, are there particular steps in the process that may, not using it in the legal sense, adverse impact, but impact women, people of color, et cetera, more than white men? We don't give an advantage to the woman of color. We look at the system itself and say, should there be a systemic change? And again, the motivation matters, not to increase diversity, but to prevent discrimination. If I can just give you one example, there are some interesting studies about screening that, and particularly one out of NYU, that when professors, regardless of their race, were reading work product, and they had a picture of a white associate and a Black associate, much more critical of the Black associate than the white associate. So that when they knew the race, the white or Black reviewer evaluated more harshly. Interestingly, in schools, in younger schools, K through 12, there are some studies that show when teachers know it's a boy and not a girl, and I think I can use those words for kids, they're harsher when they know it's a boy than a girl. So the implicit bias can go in many different directions. The idea of blind screening, I'm not going to see as a managing partner, as a manager of an IT group, the pictures or any information that would identify the race or the sex. That's helping to cut out a barrier that would screen out, as opposed to lifting up a particular group. I still think employers can, and I would add, should consider things like that. That's only one suggestion. But again, that motivation, and it's in EEOC guidance and DOJ guidance, the purpose of that's not to increase diversity. The purpose is to prevent discrimination. Title VII's mandate is not to have a more diverse workforce. Title VII's mandate is to stamp out discrimination, and that's what employers' focus should be.
Building on one of the things that you mentioned, because several of our Several folks from our audience have asked questions that are a form of this.
Okay.
I don't want to suggest that what you've said is that a rhetorical defense is all that someone needs to continue to do things. But a number of the questions have asked something along the lines of, let's say that there's an ERG and it's an ERG dedicated to the advancement of Latino women moving into leadership. If that gets relabeled to say, this is a group for everyone interested in advancing Latino women into leadership, is that actually safer? Is that in any way, what would be your assessment of such a move to make sure that the group itself's membership was no longer exclusive if the purpose of the group remained to advance or benefit a particular subset that falls into one of the five categories Title VII cares about?
Next wave of litigation, wave one of litigation has been ERGs that are closed. Next wave of litigation is going to be ERGs that are open, but I'm using the word functionally because it's in some of the internal documents in DOJ are geared toward a particular group. So thoughtful leaders should be saying, if we have an ERG for women, or we have an ERG for LGBTQ or for Latino, it could be any group, will the programming in that have value for individuals that don't fall within that identity? If the answer is no, it doesn't mean it's unlawful, but I think you're going to see challenges. And I think that's going to be the next wave. So when I've had the opportunity to work with employers in this area, one of the things I've suggested is, number one, think about maybe rather than doing something on, you know, think of interfaith, intergenerational, something on culture, something on gender. So it's focuses on how gender issues in the workplace, race issues, but not one specific identity within that. And think about how your programming maybe limiting or inviting.
Sure. Allison, did you want to add anything there?
No, I think we basically agree. If the program's relabeled in a way that's basically a fig leaf and it's sort of obviously more or less exclusive to members of one particular group, I think it still violates the law. Something that's done indirectly to benefit one particular group is as bad as something that's done directly. If it really does appear to be an effort to build something more neutral that's open to everybody, then my answer would be different. The only other note I'd say, this is something that we've heard from our fellow mentor, Gail Harriet, Dan, is think about what you would do if the races were on the other foot. So for example, if you had a whites-only recruiting group that was in theory open to everybody interested in the fate of whites, would anybody actually believe this? I humbly submit that the answer is probably not. And so you should use that kind of principle of consider flipping the races when looking at mentorship, fellowships, and so on in the other context.
Sure.
And I think employers, okay, if I jump in, Dan?
No, go, please.
Just to build on what Allison said, I think we're going to see some of those challenges where, whether it be gender, sex, or race, or ethnicity, organization as a women's group, and then a group of men say, we would like our own initiative, open to all. And the organization says, someone with loose lips says, nice pal, nice job, pal, if you think you can get it, but you're not getting it here. Then that's a distinction on a term or condition of employment that has some value directly based on sex. So what employers should be doing, I suggest, is establishing before those requests come in order to have our organization support your ERG, you need to have a business purpose and a business value. And if you can't show the purpose and the value, we're going to say no. If you can, we're going to say yes. So look, I do a lot of work in the HR world, and I talked with one company and they said 80% of our HR professionals are women. And they said, so when a group of men said we want an ERG, we said, sure. And I said, but just make sure it's open to women too. And the programming would be, so I think we have to anticipate that we're going to have requests by groups, by a straight group, by a white group, by a male group. I have to acknowledge, and this is where my intellectual consistency may be undermined by my tempered, by my emotional reaction. Something feels different for me about a white group than and yet I'm struggling how that fits within the law. I'm just acknowledging that it feels different to me emotionally.
Sure. And folding off of this in a different direction, back towards something that was mentioned earlier at the suggestion of anonymous attendee. How about the law firm that in its internal policies allows, I mean, the questioner was talking about charitable donations through the firm, but we could even broaden this and also say perhaps pro bono work, that they happily do such things for, I don't know, LGBTQ initiatives or organizations, but do not for, say, religiously conservative faith structures. How is that going to play out?
We have an hour. So yeah. let me deal with the cultural issue first.
Yeah.
What would you exclude? Whether you're left, right, or somewhere in between. When we talk about diversity, it's diversity of thought and perspective. And that should include faith, and that should include public policy perspectives. Maybe that sounds a little better than political views, but it should include. What I would tell you is there's basically a couple line of cases. One line of case would say, so long as you exclude matches on charity or ERGs with against all religions or an atheist group, you're okay because you're not treating one religion different from another. There's another line of cases, and I think if you look at some of the guidance from the EOC, if you allowed a child care, an elder care, another group that's personal in nature, and you said no to religion, that could be hostility to religion across the board. And I think those cases are going to be filed. And I think with the right court, they may be successful.
Yeah, I can absolutely imagine a firm choosing to have a rule in place where as long as you're talking about a 501c3, we don't ask any questions. And I can also imagine a firm drawing on a different line of cases, not even one of the ones that you'd mentioned, but one of the religious liberty for employers. If the Hobby Lobbies of the world turn around and say, yes, you're right, we are only going to allow donations to, you know, whatever particular stripe of religious organizations, and there are organizations that we will not be donating to. On the one hand, I can imagine this is an employment law question being problematic. On the other, I find it hard to square with the court's jurisprudence on the religious freedom of the employer to say that they can't do that. And I have no idea how it plays out.
Yeah. I think an employer potentially could discriminate under its Title VII and potentially First Amendment right for particular charities. Yeah. I was focusing on which ones they chose to match, and if they exclude the conservative leaning or left leaning, they may get a claim. There still may be a defense by the employer, depending on who the employer is.
Yeah.
When people would sometimes say in law school, you'll remember, if we can avoid a constitutional issue by resolving on statutory grounds, if I can avoid a statutory issue and look at it on a cultural grounds, do you really want to limit your matches to one faith or exclude one faith? And just ask the question, what's the cultural rebound of that?
Yeah, sure. see if we have, we've got a couple additional ones that I should pose to y'all. Has creed ever been interpreted as a classification beyond religion to encompass philosophical, ideological, or political views?
The under Title VII,
yeah.
Sincerely, hold one second.
Yeah.
Let me just pull a PowerPoint for my for talk tomorrow. Title VII, in order for an employee to have protection, he or she must only have a sincerely held religious belief. The Supreme Court has said that belief in God or the divine is not necessary for legal protection, and that non-theistic beliefs also could be religious within the meaning of the statute. Now, this is going to be as clear as mud, warning. So long as they occupy in the life of that individual a place filled that, by God in traditionally religious persons. I have to be candid, I don't know exactly what that means. The courts have basically said that a creed would need to have some fundamental and ultimate questions that deal with deep and imponderable matters. Again, I'm not exactly sure what that means, but the courts generally have said that there are four categories of so-called beliefs that are not religious. One, political philosophies, but that can overlap with religion. Two, economic philosophies, that also can overlap with religion. Social philosophies and personal preferences. You'll understand why there's going to be a lot of cases over the next 10 years trying to figure out how to draw those lines.
No, absolutely. That seems fair, at least to me. I'm also reminded that, like, I know in nonprofit law, there have been, you know, a whole series of cases where the IRS tried to say that an organization was not a religion. And there's a whole series of cases because eventually, you know, they might have won several times. But if, you know, the Church of Scientology keeps coming back and asserting, no, really, we're a church, I don't think it's terribly surprising that after some number of decades, if people keep saying this is my religion, at some point, the courts don't feel comfortable having the federal government declare what isn't a religion. And that, you know, that might point us in one direction, even if there is a flip side that, you know, this might in fact be urban legend, that famously there was a street gang in Chicago that at some point, and this is why you really need to talk to your lawyers before taking a litigation strategy, decided that that they couldn't be, that they were going to avoid prosecution for street crime by declaring that the Blackstone Rangers were now a church, and that the membership in it, there's some line that fails a smell test, but if they get at it for some number of decades, I don't know how long that would take. There's one more question that I will ask that someone has submitted, and I think we're probably
also just, we should talk about training also, by the way, if we have time.
Please. You know what? Go ahead and do that. Let's do that instead.
Okay. The EOC, in their guidance, specifically said, asked the question, could training on DEI create a hostile work environment? And the EOC doesn't say, yes, it does. It says throughout, yes, it may. And if training, and there's a Second Circuit case on this, if there are negative attributes attributed to people based on their race, based on their sex, based on their religion, that alone probably is not severe or pervasive enough under federal law, but under some state or city ordinances, it may be. But if it spills outside, if the training does its job and it encourages more negative stereotyping outside of it, as in the Second Circuit case, that may be enough. So think about some of the words that were used, you know, white privilege, attributing to all white folks certain privilege with a negative connotation. In the DOJ guidance, toxic masculinity. If that's being trained, that there's a way to be a man, you know, going back to the gender stereotyping cases, we said, well, you can't stereotype someone, you can't discriminate against someone if they don't meet the stereotype. Now we're saying, well, if you meet the stereotype, that's a problem too. Don't meet it, you meet it. If someone called a woman the B word, I think we'd all say the nexus to gender was clear. Why isn't toxic masculinity a toxic and sexist expression that needs to be banished? So when you hire a trainer, if they're a little too woke and they're still using these words, you got to talk to them first. You got to see these words are inflammatory. And if someone is told that just by virtue of who they are, their religion, their race, their sex, their orientation, they have privilege and others are oppressed just based on who they are. If nothing else, and I don't know, Allison, if you would agree with me on this, people are going to be pissed off. Pissed off people go to lawyers and lawyers bring claims. So I don't know whether those terms are enough to create a lawsuit, but they're enough to get someone to a lawyer.
To follow up, my public interest law firm, Pacific Legal Foundation, has a case pending. I believe it's currently being heard in the Ninth Circuit on very similar facts. Our client, Joshua Demert, was a social worker based in Seattle. His department adopted a series of really inflammatory trainings, and Demert's coworkers took up some of the more negative stereotypes involving white people and males and repeatedly brought them up in Demert's presence, to the point that he essentially views himself as constructively fired. He had to resign from the role. And so this, while I think that the ordinarily a DEI training that has just one or two stray offensive or distasteful remarks isn't, however distasteful to me, going to rise to the level of hostile environment, the kind of pattern of discriminatory harassment thrown at somebody like Mr. Demert does, I think, rise to the level of what would constitute a Title VII violation. And so not just because I'm a PLF employee, because I'm an American who values the principles of race neutrality and gender neutrality, I hope that he prevails on his claims.
Sure. And I mean, in a post-Ames world, one might expect that that should, in fact, be the case, whether or not the Ninth Circuit cares. So
the case name, by the way, is Demert versus City of Seattle. Should anybody in the audience care to look it up after the talk's over?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I think we probably don't have enough time to cycle back for one of those questions. So with apologies to
our
anonymous attendee, we do appreciate your contribution and would have otherwise done so. I think this was great. I really appreciate both of y'all. And Matthew, I think we're turning it back to you.
All right, thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.